On today's episode of the Dream World Podcast, we have a guest, Jim Matlock, who's a researcher with the Parapsychology Foundation of New York City. And for years, he's been studying reincarnation and the physical scientific evidence behind the entire process. We answer the biggest questions of life. What happens after death? What happens in between lives? How do we choose our lives and how many times do we come back? There's so many questions regarding these phenomenons, and we're just going to dive right into it here on the Dream World Podcast.
I'm really happy that you're here because you're going to be talking about a topic that I've always been fascinated about, because I believe that when we know about our past lives and we try and reconnect it with our current lives, I believe it can bring balance in our life. And yeah, I can't wait to hear from you and everything you've learned along the way and learn from you.
I've been studying this for a while now. I got interested in reincarnation, actually. You know, I'm 66, so I've been around a little bit longer than you guys, I guess, and probably most of your listeners, too. I went to college in the early part of the 1970s. I took a lot of psychology courses. I was interested in psychology. And at the time, I was at Emory University in Atlanta. And at the time, they were teaching psychology more from a behaviorist point of view, from B.F. Skinner. People know that. You know, and by the time I graduated, I was really sort of dissatisfied with that. I mean, it just seemed so limiting. And I thought, there has to be more to the person than I remember asking my mother around that time, you know, when babies are born, do they already have personalities, or do their personalities sort of develop, you know, as they grow? Because the behaviorist idea was everything is conditioned by the environment, by things that happen. And so what you would expect from a behaviorist point of view is that the babies come in, you know, completely, you know, there's a tabula rasa, right? A blank slate. But my mother said, no. She said, when babies are born, they already have personalities and they just get stronger. Every baby is different and the personalities get stronger as they grow. So that was sort of consistent with what the questioning I was already having. And so in the 1970s, I began to read more in the New Age sort of literature, which was coming out around that time. It was really beginning to get started in the 1970s. And as I read more and got more interested in these subjects, I found that there was actually serious research being done in this area in the field called parapsychology. Now, parapsychology has become sort of, in the popular conception, sort of diluted. People don't really understand what it is. But there actually is an academic discipline called parapsychology, which looks at issues like extrasensory perception and psychokinesis, mind over matter, looks at them experimentally and also studies people's experiences systematically. And then another branch of parapsychology is concerned with the evidence for life after death through mediums, apparitions, and then reincarnation. Now, the reincarnation stuff began really in 1961. The other areas are older, going back to like 1882, which is when the first association was founded. It was Ian Stevenson, who was a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, who started the systematic study of reincarnation in 1961. That's when he first went into the field. He went to India and Ceylon, now it's called Sri Lanka, on his first field trip. And what he did is actually go and talk to the children, to children's families, and they were mainly children who had these past life memories. And so he actually went into the field and actually talked to people who had these children and their families who claimed to have these past life memories. And in many of his cases, the memories actually could be checked out. They could be verified. The children remembered things in enough detail and gave names of places of people that the people that they remembered having been actually could be confirmed as having actually lived and died in the ways that they said. And at that point, once they solved the case, that's the term he came to use for it. Once you knew the previous person, then you began to see similarities of personality, similarities in behavior, and other things that might flow, phobias and things that flowed from the way the person had died. And so there are all these behavioral and emotional consistencies too. It wasn't just these memories. Then when I came to this in 1980, he had been doing this for about 20 years. And so he'd published some stuff. And I was very intrigued by it because, let's face it, if reincarnation is real, I mean, you know, that, you know, we have to rethink a lot of things. And so I was very intrigued by it. And but the more I got into it, the more it seemed like there was really something here. And that's why I've stayed with it, because the more I've studied it, the more I convinced I become. Okay. So yeah. Do I believe in reincarnation? Yes, I do. But I believe in reincarnation on the basis of the evidence. I didn't start off this believing. I had a sort of interest, you know, in it, but, you know, in the idea of the possibility, but I became convinced through the data, through the research.
Your story about reincarnation really fascinates me, because I had a near-death experience in 2016, and I had an out-of-body experience, and I was seeing my body, you know, and my spirit, and I knew I had to enter it. So, but, you know, sometimes when we go to sleep, you know, there is a difference between dreams, you know. You can see a dream, but then there is something sometimes that you see and it's like a life you've lived, you know, but you don't know when that was, you know, but it plays out. And, you know, this is not just a dream because it feels so real, like you lived that life. So I think maybe it's memories we carry from our past, you know, selves. Mm-hmm. So I guess since we're already interacting, what I would like to ask is when you talk about reincarnation, are you going for it in the more scientifically proven fact, or are you going to it in the spiritually ancient wisdom kind of fact? Where are you coming from on the subject? Are you coming from science and then fact, and this is what has happened, or more you leave room to spirituality and, you know, the mysteries that surround it?
Well, there certainly is room for spirituality. I mean, we get into that, but I'm more on the scientific side. I mean, I start with the science first, and then try to understand what the science says about the spirituality. I mean, I'm not disinterested in the spirituality, but it's there. I mean, for me, it's more important to start with the science and to see what the science tells, and let the science then inform the spirituality, rather than starting with the spirituality and letting that tell me about what I should believe. So, I mean, I get to spirituality, but I start with the science.
What have you really learned, you know, about souls that reincarnate? You know, like when we come, how do we remember who we are? How do you think, you know, people should go about that? How do they remember who they used to be? And what do you think is the purpose of us remembering? You know, how do you think it helps us?
Essentially, you're asking, how does this work? How does reincarnation work? And how does past life memory work? How can we remember? For me, I think that it has to do with basically consciousness, right? I think that people say the soul is what reincarnates. Well, I think if we think of the soul as being consciousness or mind, we can put it in a way that maybe is more scientific, if we want to say it that way, but in a way that we can actually understand what it is that reincarnates. Because the word soul, the concept of soul, it's very, very vague, right? But if we say it's consciousness, so what I mean by that is that when we die, when our bodies die, our consciousness, our minds just continue to exist. And you said you experienced an out of body. You had an out of body experience. A fair number of people have. And so it's the same sort of thing. I mean, you are out of your body, and, you know, when you die, you're out of your body, right? But your consciousness continued. And so I think the consciousness just continues through the period we call death until that consciousness reunites with a new body, right? And that's what we call reincarnation. Now, for memories and also personality, emotions, all of this sort of content, which makes up our personalities, makes up who we are, I believe is recorded in the subconscious parts of our minds, not the conscious awareness part of our minds, but the subconscious parts, because we have to remember that we also have a subconscious, right? we're all sort of aware of that too. And I believe it's in the subconscious that our memories are stored, not in our brains, because our brains die. I mean, you know, how can we remember previous lives if we're in different bodies, right? So I believe all of that, all of the memories are in our subconscious mind. And then after we reincarnate, they're still there. They're still there in our subconscious mind, because remember, it's just our consciousness, which is just continuing, right? And so the issue then is, how do the memories come up from the subconscious to the conscious awareness? Okay, so that's the question there. So there are various ideas about that. It turns out that past life memory is very much like this life memory in its characteristics. It can be jogged the same way by association. It can be triggered by things that we see or hear or smell, that matter, maybe even taste. You know, all of the senses that can bring up memories of the present life can also bring up memories of the past life. It's, if you think of it that way, it's really not so strange, really, you know. It makes all makes sense, you know, and so that's where I got to, you know, in trying to understand this. And when I got to that point, when it all sort of fit together and made sense, that's when I stopped, you know, questioning this and said, okay, look, there's so much evidence. I have a way of understanding it. This makes sense, at least to me. You know, at that point, I had to say, look, I mean, the only intellectually responsible thing is to say reincarnation does occur. Right.
So what I was asking was, when you were talking about the consciousness, how it continues out of your body into different bodies, it kind of makes sense in terms of where it goes. Is it still existing within our world and it's just like an invisible type of energy, or does it go to some other dimension and come back, or how would you put it into words?
Yeah, no, that's another really good question, because people often imagine, you know, even something like heaven is imagined to be another place, right? And they talk about planes of existence. And I tend to think of these planes as being more, not like physical planes that we're going anywhere, but more like psychological planes of, you know, like, you know, mystical experience and other types of spiritual experience. They're altered states, basically. I tend to think that the spirits are all around us, basically. They haven't gone anywhere. They're here. Their consciousness has, and not necessarily developed or evolved, but simply it gotten more mystical, right? You know, and not as closely tied. And that's why it can be difficult for somebody on a spiritual plane, as they say, to get back and connect to those of us who are in our material bodies. But it can be done, and it is done. And this comes back again to the importance of extrasensory perception, because when you talk about out-of-body experiences, and you get the same thing with near-death experiences, they, NDEers, will talk about seeing things in the operating room, seeing other things, and their physical senses at that point are closed down. And you get the same thing in reincarnation cases, in what are called intermission memories, which are memories of the period between death and rebirth. Same sorts of things where they're seeing things. I mean, in this case, they see the accident scene or the hospital scene where they actually died, right? And they might see their burial. And they can see other things that went on. Sometimes they see their parents before they were conceived, even, or, you know, while they're in the womb, they'll see things, they'll describe things that actually happened, it turns out. These sorts of veridical perceptions can't just be passed away. I mean, they have to be explained, right? I mean, they're real, they're not fantasies. We know they're not fantasies because they check out, right? So those are all examples of extrasensory perception. And it's that extrasensory ability there that allows the spirits both to communicate with each other, with other spirits, right? And also with living people, right? Sometimes through mediums, sometimes through dreams. And, it's very common in these cases for pregnant women to have dreams of their children. In the dreams, the children will give their identities, their previous identities, right? I mean, in the dreams, it's sort of a reincarnation dream. I mean, the reincarnating person saying, I'm coming to you. That's this type of contact then between the deceased person and a living person, that is carried out through, you know, through these extrasensory ways. The extrasensory dimension is very important here. Most of the world is not really attuned to these things, not used to thinking of them in this way. But once we do begin to think of them in this way and realize how much evidence there is for all of this that I'm talking about, then it all falls into place. It fits, you know, and at that point, it begins to make sense.
So how do you think, like you were talking about the children who describe their dreams of their past life experiences and all that, you know, I know there's so many cases around the world. And I also know that maybe in, you know, on our, on, you know, the Western side, maybe children, like parents don't pay as much attention to children's dreams as much as maybe on, you know, the Eastern side of the world. How do you think that children that like grow up, like with their parents paying attention to their dreams and talking about their dreams and like encouraging these talks of the past life experiences, do you think that those memories stay with us longer versus we just forgetting them?
It does seem from cases that there is more retention. The memories do stay longer if the parents honor them rather than just putting them down. And also if a case can be solved, I mean, if the children remember enough details, either in a dream or a waking state, and because with children, it's often in the waking state that these comes. In adults, it's more often in dreams. But with children, it's very often these things will come in the waking state. But they have dreams too, sometimes nightmares, night terrors, that type. But yeah, the memories, whether they're waking or dream, the ones when the parents accept them, and the ones where they make attempts to verify them and are verified, those tend to last longer. I mean, one can sort of understand that, right? I mean, if it's been confirmed, in a sense, socially confirmed, the child, in a sense, has permission, right, to remember it, psychological permission. And they do hold on to it longer.
Yeah, makes sense for sure. And what about, can you speak a little bit on like kind of like the intermission period? What happens? How do we kind of like choose, or do we choose like how our next life is going to go or what our body is? And like, is there like a limit on how many times we come back, or how does that work?
Well, okay, I'll take the last question first. Sure. A limit on how many times we come back. We don't know. I mean, this is really no way of knowing. You know, and maybe I can come back to this if you want me to talk about the philosophy and theory a little bit. But I mean, we don't have any way of knowing. And it's possible that, you know, we've all had innumerable lives, right? We just don't know. Okay, so but to talk about the intermission period and what that's like. Yeah, I mean, the children who do, and about 20%, I mean, I want to say that because these memories are not uncommon. In about 20% of these cases of children who recall things about previous lives, they'll also recall the period between lives, the intermission period. So these are not rare memories. You know, oftentimes they will remember how they selected their new parents. Sometimes the reincarnation is in the same family, in the family line at least. Maybe not in the same nuclear family, but to a relative. But in many cases, it's not. In many cases, it's to a stranger from the previous life. There are these emotional associations, affinities to the new parents. They like them for some reason. They feel drawn to them for some reason. So that's an important part of the intermission memories. Whether, you know, they don't all include this, though. They don't all include the memory of coming to the parents. It's a common feature of them. It's sort of like, structurally, they're very similar to near-death experiences. And more people are familiar with near-death experiences now, you know, that in the stages of the near-death experience, that, you know, there's the stage immediately after death and immediately after, you know, whatever causes the NDE, it's not really a death because you come back to the body. But whatever that is that triggers it is the, and then there's this, sometimes called transcendental phase, which is the in-between period. And then there's the return to the body. Well, with intermission memories, you know, it's sort of similar to that. You have a stage where you sort of, where you, the body, you leave the body because it's dead. And then there's a period where between the lives, and then there's a period of coming back to a body, right? But then within a missionary's is also a period of life in the womb, of remembering the gestation period. And some children remember the birth too. So within a mission memories, we talk about those five stages: immediately after death, between bodies, the selection of the parents, which I was talking about, being in the womb and in birth. And one of the very interesting things about this is that there, when we talk about the second stage there, the stage, you know, the longest stage, right, between death and then choosing the parents, we see very marked differences between Asian and mission memories and Western ones. In the Western ones, they'll often talk about having been in heaven, right? Being with Jesus, maybe they'll say, being with angels. Sometimes seeing people that they knew before, but very often talking about these other spirit entities that they interpret in those ways. Whereas in Asia, they don't talk about Jesus. They don't talk about angels. They talk about figures that are appropriate for their culture, right? So but they have the same roles. They have the same function. They're just perceived differently, or they're interpreted differently, right? That's interesting, I think. It suggests that these entities are real, but the way they're perceived is through a cultural frame. But there's another way that they're different too, and that is in Asia, the intermission period is typically imagined to pass in the same terrestrial plane. I mean, this comes back to the earlier question of where do we go when we die? And this is one of the reasons why I say maybe we don't go anywhere, because they will talk about not having gone to heaven, but talk about hanging out in a tree, hanging out in one case in a conch shell, the house, in some sort of a realistic terrestrial setting. And from that vantage, watching things going on, which they'll talk about and actually did happen, as it turns out. Whereas in the West, they do talk about heaven, all right? They don't talk about being in this terrestrial setting. They may still see things that are going on in the terrestrial world, our world, through their clairvoyance, but they don't imagine themselves as being part of that world in the way they do in Asia. So I think culture plays a very big part here, right? In what is experienced and how it's understood. And so this is why I think that it's not so much a matter of going somewhere to another place when we die. It's just a matter of changing our consciousness, right? Our frame of reference. It's altered states. I mean, we're going to different altered states, perhaps. The experiences and whatever altered state we happen to be in are very much influenced by our previous life, right? By the things we believed in our previous life, by our previous cultures. Those carry over, in our subconscious and our minds. I mean, those just carry over and they influence our experience. At least that's how it seems to me. And, similar with near-death experiences, those also, there's a similar structure and yet they vary quite a lot. And to a good extent, they vary according to culture. So it seems to be the same sort of thing. Dirk is a member of my Facebook group, Signs of Reincarnation. And for those of your listeners or either of you, if you're on Facebook, come to that group, Signs of Reincarnation. Okay, Dirk, you had a question for me.
Well, I just wanted to add to what you were saying about the difference between Asia and the West in regards to what happens after death. And my wife is a medium, and my father died, I guess it was a couple of years ago. And very soon after he died, he asked for permission to live in our basement. And he really wanted to clean up because it's such a mess down there. And then he decided to leave. So I don't know where he's at now. But I just thought I'd add to that there's probably, people who die in the West who actually do hang out.
Yeah.
Don't go anywhere for a while because never said anything about Jesus or heaven. I mean, he was an atheist. I mean, he never talked about spirit guides or anybody like that. He was met by his father, my grandfather.
Uh-huh.
You know, my grandfather had to show him around and explain how things worked in their environment. You know, like when he died, he had a very serious foot problem. He wanted a new foot. So, I mean, my grandfather said, all you have to do is wish or ask for it and you get it. And that's what happened. My question is about planning. Is there any, how much evidence is there about planning for the future life in your data set? Because I'd like to know where I'm going in the future. And, you know, I'm 61 years old. I got maybe 20, 25 years left. And, you know, I was like, well, I got some time to plan, you know, for the future. And so what do I want my future to look like? Who do I want to be with? You know, what kind of life do I want to have? Is this something is there any evidence of people doing that in the record that you know of, or maybe even from some other source? I don't know. I just was curious to see what you have. So I'll just shut up and listen.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of people talk. It's a good question because a lot of people talk about this, right? I mean, it's sort of the idea that before we come back, we plan our new lives, right? Or we make pacts with ourselves, you know.
Yeah, I remember my grandmother. I asked my grandmother while she was alive. You know, she was in Unity Church and she believed in reincarnation. I said, "Well, what do you want to learn? What do you want to do in your next life?" She said, "I want to learn how to swim." It's interesting that, you know, some people actually do have a plan besides just going to heaven and hanging out with Jesus.
Right. Well, I think we need to separate the plans that are made before death and the plans that are made during the intermission. A lot of this talk about, you know, planning our lives and, you know, and so forth that you read about, hear about sometimes in the New Age type literature suggests that before we're reborn, we go for a tribunal or anyway, we plan out our lives, we see them and all, and we do not see evidence for any of that. Very rarely do we hear about any sort of life planning. Yes, the parents may be chosen, but the parents are chosen on a very basic level simply because they're drawn to them for some way. They don't talk about seeing the life they're getting into, right? They don't seem to know anything about their parents. I mean, the decisions are not made at that stage, you know, they realize that this is a rich family or deterred because they realize this is a poor family. I mean, there isn't this sort of life planning at all. And I mean, in this sort of imagination, it can get much more complex than that, right? People choose to come back to learn certain lessons and all of this. We don't see that. We just don't see evidence for that. Now, on the other hand, and this is something that many people don't realize, there are cases of people who decide before their death where they want to be reincarnated, right? They choose the family, they choose the place.
Really?
Yeah. This is particularly common in tribal societies.
Okay.
But there are cases also, I mean, there's a Brazilian case like this. The return was to a family friend. I mean, you know, the woman, young woman who was dying on her deathbed told her best friend she was going to come back to her. She said, I'll come back and I'll have memories. And sure enough, the kid did have memories and, you know, remembered this line. Yeah. You know, and then there are Tlingit Indian cases from Alaska. Well, for instance, one of the most dramatic ones, I mean, we haven't talked about the birthmarks or birth defects in these cases, but there can be physical phenomena in these cases, too. Mm-hmm. There was a fisherman who got tired of the strenuous activity of his life of throwing out these sen nets all the time to catch fish. And he decided, well, he didn't want to go through this in his next life.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
The boy, well, yeah, but what it gets even more interesting is the boy who remembered his life was born without an arm. So he wouldn't have to do that. And he ended up in clerical jobs on land and was quite happy with all of that. So, yeah, I mean, it does seem that we can, we can make plans, not only where to come back, but we can make plans and carry them out about even what sort of body we want to have. I mean, within limitations, of course, but it does seem possible to make these sorts of plans before death. And what's interesting is that there is more evidence for effectual planning before death than there is during the intermission. Why that should be, I don't know, but that's what we see.
I was talking to my grandfather through my wife, and he has a girlfriend in the other world. And I said, well, you know, Gene, his name's Gene. So, you know, you can get married. You can get married there, you know, if you want to. And he kind of laughed a little bit and didn't say anything. And he said, yeah, there was a couple that wanted to reincarnate together to be married together. And he said they went to this room with these beings, and then he never saw them again. And so I just was wondering, is there any evidence of people planning to be married in a future life? Time together.
I mean, I'd love to give my philosophical perspective on it. I'm a big believer in it. And, you know, I take science past the boundaries of our physical limitations of our 3D world. But I'm a strong believer in that we do tend to reincarnate with our, same consciousness, the same way we're social creatures on Earth. We incarnate, you know, we can maybe choose to come back and try to spend more time with our loved ones in maybe different ways or different bodies. But going back to what you said about the planning before death, I don't know if you guys know, but the Dalai Lama, the way that they choose in that culture to reincarnate the new Dalai Lama, every time he dies, he says, they do a lot of rituals and planning, and he says, he gives it down to the location of where he's going to be born, and selects a certain object as well. And then when they find the child, that's how they confirm it. For centuries, that's how they've done it, which has always fascinated me as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, the cases that have been studied are very similar to this. But what is interesting, is, particularly in the tribal cultures, they go a step further. You're right. I mean, in the Tibetan tradition, they will say, look for me in this certain area, right? They don't say the family that they're going to be in. With Tlingit Haida, and also like this Brazilian case, they chose the family. And it's more specific than that. They don't say just, I'm coming back to this specific area. And I don't understand why the Tibetans do it that way, make it in this more of a mystery thing. Because it's clear that you can actually choose the family. We have a number of family cases, like I said. I mean, you know, if a baby is born, if dies very young, will often come back in the same family. I mean, as long as the mother is still of childbearing age, it's very common for children to come back in the same nuclear family. And older people will come back to relatives. I mean, they'll come back as grandchildren, great grandchildren, or, you know, with some sort of, you know, so those sorts of links suggest that there is, the capacity to select, because how else are you going to end up in the same family? Or even more to the point, acquaintances. If there wasn't something linking you to an acquaintance, why would it be the acquaintance? So how do we know this? I'm talking about cases that have been verified. I'm talking about soft cases where the children grow up actually saying things and giving some sort of evidence to their behaviors or, you know, physically or something like that, in addition to their memories that they actually were this person. There are, there's a twin case where a couple in Burma, a married couple, mm-hmm. came back as twins. And there is either Thai or Burmese case where a couple and actually their children were killed in the same night. Children who remembered both of father and the mother, the couple, were reborn around the same time. He was sort of interested in getting back with her, but she was not very interested in getting back with him. And that came back. In principle, I don't see why, you know, couples could not decide to be, you know, reincarnated in the same area independently and then meet up again. But I don't think we have a case like that.
Yes, that's right. Hello, Jim. Hello, everyone. I have actually two questions, Jim. You said that it's very common that grandparents do reincarnate in the same family as children. But we also have a lot of cases where the reincarnation did occur in other families. Mm-hmm. I have been reading a lot of the Druze cases. They are very interesting. How come that they do reincarnate in other families than their own, even when they didn't have any problems with their previous family? We see also some cases where the person who still has feelings for his previous family.
I think that's a good question, and I don't know that we really know the answer. The percentage of family cases versus stranger cases varies cross-culture. In tribal societies, particularly those with lineal structures, they trace the kinship to the father or the mother exclusively. Those societies, they tend to be almost 100% cases in the family. In most other societies, it's a lot less than that. In India, it's only like, I think, 14% or something like that are family cases. I think in Lebanon, where the Druze live, it's similar. It's low like that. So how come in Europe and the States, there's a higher proportion of family cases, but a lower proportion of overall cases that are solved? It may not be that there are more family cases in the West. It may just be that it's harder to solve a case with a stranger relationship in the West. And so it seems like there are more, right? So like in the United States, only 20% of cases of past life memory that have been recorded and studied are solved, right? And of those, the great majority are family cases. Well, they're easier to solve, right? It's sort of misleading to say 90% of American cases are family cases, because that's 90% of 20%, right? You see my point. I think culture may play a role here. In Asia, and not counting Lebanon right now, I'll get to that in a second, in the Druze. But in Asia, there's this idea of karma, right? Karma is determining, particularly in Buddhism. Karma is what determines where you're reborn, right? And so it's out of your hands. And people don't think that they have that control, right? And so this could be a factor that after death, they don't even think that they could choose where they go. I mean, it's out of their hands. It's fate. It's karma that will tie that. And in Lebanon, among the Druze people, it's similar, because they, although they don't have a same concept of karma, they do believe that it's God that decides, right? Again, it's out of their hands. God will decide what family you go into, right? Whereas in the West, we don't have that idea that it's going to be, it's maybe some very religious people do think, God is going to determine everything. But probably most Westerners don't. And so they're more prepared then to take that decision on themselves. But again, like I said, I mean, it's hard to say that we really do see more family cases in the West because of these other factors.
This is very interesting. So they do take with them their beliefs to the intermission, and yeah, it affects their next life. This is very, very interesting to know. And it makes me know to how much this knowledge is so important for us. The second question I have, if grandparents want to reincarnate in their own family line and there is no children to be reborn for now, for that moment, do you have any data that the grandparents can wait for years until there is a child, there is a pregnant woman or anything to be able to reincarnate?
Yeah, no, that's another very interesting question, a very good question too. The period between lives, the intermission period, is not fixed in length. It can vary from very brief, I mean, I'm talking about a few days, 2 or 3 days in some cases. And in principle, it could be immediate. We just, but the shortest in that we have in cases, verified soft cases, is 2 or 3 days, up to seemingly hundreds of years. But now when it gets longer, in these longer intermissions, we can't be sure that they're not in immediate lives that are not recalled. The median intermission length cross-culturally, globally, is only 15, 16 months. The majority of cases that make that up, though, are Asian or, you know, Middle Eastern. When we get to Europe and the States, the Western cases, the intermissions tend to be longer. And the median intermission in stranger cases, it's a little bit shorter in family cases. In Western stranger cases, it's more like 25 years. So a big difference then between the median intermission length, you know, in Asia and the West. That doesn't mean you don't find very short intermissions in the West and you don't find longer intermissions in Asia. But it's just on balance, the median, I mean, there are a lot more short intermissions in Asia. There is this variability to work with, right? Since one doesn't have to be reincarnated immediately upon death, one can wait, right? We're getting into some really crazy stuff now. But yes, there are cases, and not just a couple of them, there are quite a number of cases where the incoming spirit seems to have decided when it wants to be reborn. And in fact, it can engineer parents getting together, it can engineer things like condoms breaking. It can there are cases of overriding tied fallopian tubes, overriding vasectomies. So if a spirit really wants to be born, it will be born no matter what obstacles are put up.
It clicks in my mind is astrology. I mean, for people who do or don't believe about astrology, the belief that we have here in the West typically of astrology is that you are the way you are because you were born at a certain time. I like to flip it around and say we were born the time we were born because of who we are. In other words, we can only be like corn. You can only plant corn at a certain time of the year, right? So my belief anyway is that we can only be born. So that person wanted to be born at a certain time. That sort of begs the question about, is astrology actually something? You know, is there some kind of astrological aspect to their timing of their birth?
Yeah, I have a little story, a personal story about my family. And I mean, I believe in astrology too, but that's just a side note. So my grandfather, before he died in 2005, I think, and he really loved life. You know, he wasn't really ready to die. He just enjoyed his life. And so he used to tell my dad all the time, like, if I could reincarnate into the family, I will, like, I will. And he kept saying that before he died. And it was kind of jokingly, that's just kind of how he was. But, you know, and then after he died, like some people, like mediums or people within where he worked would report seeing him or feeling him and stuff like that throughout the years. But then in 2010, my dad had another child with my stepmom, which all this happened after he died when he met my stepmom and all that. But so, yeah, I have a 9-year-old brother right now. And he has a lot of the very same mannerisms that my grandfather used to have. And yes, like very similar specific things, like the way he holds his hair with his hand and little things like that, and certain aspects of his personality. And even before he was born, my father talked to a medium who told him that my grandfather wanted to come back into the family. So I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, this is the cases are like this, and, you know, and there are quite a few cases where we do get these mediumistic communications, you know, during the intermission period.
My first wife had a announcing dream. I realized just now when you were talking about it, my future daughter came to her and gave her a postcard with her name on it. It said born as, and so we were going to name her, you know, Star Child, Sunflower, something. But instead, she wanted to be born Helena Alexandra. So, okay, fine. we'll name you Helena Alexandra. It's fine. But no, I realized now that was an announcing dream.
And, you know, often when these happen, and it's not that uncommon for names to be given in the announcing dreams or in, you know, in some sort of parallel situation to them, and the names that then are given to the child, which the parents weren't even considering before, right, turn out to be the names of from the previous life.
Oh, wow, I should research that. I should, for my daughter, yeah.
I heard about that.
Anyway, I do have a question. I do have a question about, are you seeing an increase in cases in the United States because of the increased awareness of reincarnation?
We're seeing an increased reporting of cases. And okay, it's hard to know whether that means that there's an increase in the cases itself.
That's what I mean, the increase in reporting.
Certainly an increase in reporting them. People are getting more comfortable in talking about these experiences.
Okay.
I think social media has a lot to do with that, right?
But I do have one last question quick here. Any kind of psychological assessment of the verified cases? I mean, a lot of what I've read in your data is that like 60% of them had violent deaths. Have you studied something like that? Have you done some kind of correlation or whatever?
Well, again, there are a whole bunch of different issues there. Erlinder Haraldson, who's just he recently passed, did psychological studies, but of the case subjects, right? You know, so we know something about the children who remember previous lives versus their peers. Because I mean, he did proper control studies with, you know, with matched control groups, things like that, and batteries of psychological tests and all of that. So we have some idea of the psychological profiles of the case subjects. Nobody has really looked at the psychological profiles of the previous lives. And there has just been very preliminary stuff that it has compared the two lives, right? More than an anecdotal level. I mean, we have got a lot of cases we can look at and we can talk about. But I mean, in a systematic way, a controlled way, there really hasn't been much of that. There was a Sri Lankan case of a boy who was born with a badly deformed, very much truncated right arm. And he recalled having been a man who had gotten upset with his bride and had killed her because she tried to back out of the marriage commitment. I can't really blame her. She probably had the right idea, but he killed her. He was hung for that. He remembered that and was very, it felt very guilty about it. And it bothered him for a very long time before he was able to work through that. There are not all that many cases like that. It's more common that a person is killed, not that they were a killer, right? You know, and they were killed or murdered and or perhaps had a severe accidental death. And those things carry over, right, in terms of phobias, in terms of traumas that have to be dealt with. So there are these things that carry over. But I don't think that it would be fair to think of the previous persons in these cases as being in any sense psychologically troubled. We don't see that. I mean, that comes up occasionally, but rarely. And it's more common than just average people who, you know, met an untimely end of one sort or another. There are also some cases of natural deaths. Though in the majority of cases, it was, you know, either a murder or an accident or disease or something that took them early.
Why is this studies not well known by other science men?
Yeah, I think it's just that there is a great deal of resistance to it because our sciences are in, it started in the West and, you know, and other parts of the world have sort of emulated the West in this. I think the West has the right ideas. It's so materialist now. There is this idea that everything begins with the physical, right? And that includes our bodies, that our consciousness is not separate from our bodies. Our consciousness is generated by our brains, is the idea. And if that's the case, if there cannot be any sort of survival, then there can't be reincarnation, right? So the whole issue then is sort of foreclosed by this materialistic mindset, which is so fundamental to our sciences now. But the remarkable thing about this is that quantum mechanics, if we're wrenching all of this, you know, back before quantum mechanics came into the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, it's not new. So we've had more than a century now to get used to the implications of this. So we're not living in a Newtonian world anymore, right? And there's really no reason to think that the world has to be materialistic anymore. And yet the majority of scientists still hold to the materialistic point of view. There's still a lot of scientists who, even with quantum mechanics, will try to find interpretations that do not, you know, lead to consciousness being independent of the physical. Although that is the easiest way to understand quantum mechanics, and that was what was understood by the founders of quantum mechanics, is that consciousness is separate from the physical, and then consciousness is important. It has to be separate in order to make the quantum theory work. There are more and more people, philosophers, neuroscientists, psychologists, biologists, who are beginning to question materialism, particularly, I would say, in the last 20 years or so. And so things are breaking down. I mean, you know, the scientific materialist, you know, worldview is being challenged now on several different fronts. And we can see this changing. Science does change. When I was in high school, there were still debates about plate tectonics and continental drift. That back then, that was still a pseudoscience. In the 60s, it was still a pseudoscience. And now it's basic to geology because they understand how it works. They found the mechanism. And I think until we have a really acceptable theory of survival and reincarnation, that's going to continue. But part of that is that materialism has to break down. People have to become aware that the materialistic worldview, it's a philosophy. I mean, it's not fact. And they have to begin to be aware of all of the scientifically collected data. But at this point, so much that's in parapsychology and, you know, particularly in reincarnation studies and survival and all that, is just dismissed. It's just dismissed. They don't pay any attention to it because they're sure that it cannot be right. And therefore, they don't even bother to look at the data. Okay? So it's not just that the data is not well known. They may know that there is this data out there, but they're so sure that there's nothing to it, they won't bother even to look at it. You know, there's this saying that science advances one death at a time. You know, it may take more than one death at a time, but it advances over the generations at that speed. It takes younger people who think in different ways, who have new questions, who are not so scared of looking at the data, not so sure of themselves, who then can bring new ways of thinking about things into the scientific arena. And this I see happening. I teach an online course also called Signs of Reincarnation. And I get a lot of students, you know, grad students and even upper level college students. I'm hopeful that we're beginning to see this change now. And with this, your generation, for many of you, and the next generation coming up, I mean, you're already showing, you know, that you're open to these ideas. And, you know, that this is what is going to change. You know, my generation is hopeless. but the next generations are not. I mean, and that's when things are going to change.
Yeah, the times are definitely changing. I can definitely see that. And science just changes, even in my own lifetime, like, like there's been so many changes and updates and advances you constantly have to know. And it makes me, I wanted to ask you what types of experiments and like, where do you see that going into the future? I know there's like a budget and an interest that maybe still is not there, but what is like the future for the research in terms of like, how can we keep experimenting this from like a scientific point of view?
Right. Yeah, well, we need to. There are a couple of things we need to do. At this point, I would say the bulk of the research is still case studies, which is a problem because for many scientists and philosophers or scientists, those are just anecdotes. Even though the type of case studies that Stevenson did that are studied, that are done in this, are not just going out and collecting stories, right? They're actually researched. You know, so they go out and they talk. Like I was saying at the beginning, Stevenson went out and talked to people. He talked to all firsthand witnesses he could. He collected lots of documents. He backed up everything he could. So they're not just, so his case studies are not just anecdotes. They go beyond that. And yet they still tend to be dismissed as anecdotes because they're not laboratory based. It starts with the case studies because the case studies give us our data. But then we need to move beyond that data to an analysis of patterns. And we've done that. Okay. Then we need to take those patterns and develop a theory and begin to develop hypotheses. That's the stage we're at now. And then once we have those hypotheses, then we can go into the laboratory and start exploring in the lab. And then other scientists will take us more seriously. There are a number of laboratory studies that it would be very interesting to do. Some things in neuroscience, for instance. I mean, it'd be very interesting to do neurological studies looking at people with past life memory, okay? Looking at how similar the patterns of past life remembering is to this life remembering, right? Because we can see that the brain lights up in different places if somebody's actually remembering something versus fantasizing. Well, it would be very interesting if somebody having past life memories is more like memory than fantasy. Now, wouldn't that be interesting? But so that's one type of study that can be done. Another type of study that would be very interesting to do, and Stevenson proposed this, but it never really happened. And I've mentioned, but we've touched on some of the physical things. But some of the physical things, I mean, they're pretty crazy stuff, like the birthmarks. If somebody is shot, there will often be two birthmarks, one for the entrance wound and one for the exit wound on the back of the body. The body will have two birthmarks. And what Stevenson wanted to do in those cases is do imaging studies inside the body to see whether not only the birthmarks, but whether there are internal, so we say internal birthmarks, whether there are internal tracks through the body. You know, one reason to expect that, and we can hypothesize that, you see, we can hypothesize it and then go look and see whether that hypothesis is confirmed or not. There are a number of cases where we do see internal issues. We do see diseases. For instance, there was this is an American case, a man, an off-duty policeman who was working as a security guard. Maybe he was retired by policeman, then he was a security guard. But anyway, he was off-duty at the time, went into a convenience store that was in the process of being robbed, and he tried to intervene. But he didn't realize that there was more than one person involved in this, and he got shot in the chest. The child was born with very severe heart conditions, kind of issues that if he had not been in the States or Western Europe would not have survived, you know, if you didn't have modern medicine and be able to immediately treat these sorts of things. This is the sort of thing in the past, the person who would not have survived. But the child, after he's born, had severe heart disease, right? Very much mirroring, you know, what had happened to, and this is a family case, I believe it was a grandfather or something like that, a couple of generations back in his family. You know, and we can get, in these kinds of cases, we get medical documents on both sides. We get medical documents for the previous life. We get medical documents for the for their current life, you know, and we can match everything up. So there is reason to think that in other cases, there are going to be these physical traces. Well, if there are, that's the sort of thing we can investigate, right? We can hypothesize that on the basis of the data that we've already collected, and we can go and look for it and confirm or deny it, right? And that's the sort of thing that we need to begin to do to put this on a more scientific basis. But we're just now getting to the point where we can do that, because it starts with the cases, and then we have to analyze the cases, look at the pattern. And then once we have the patterns in place, then we can start working on theory, developing hypotheses, and then the next and last stage is testing.
You know, the idea came up about the possibility that at least some or more of the birth defects that children are born with is related to past lives.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of begs the question, why would they have a birth defect if everything else was, you know, kind of normal with the gestation, the pregnancy period, and the parents are normal, there's no genetic abnormalities going on or whatever, and they suddenly have a child with a birth defect? If there was a really great way to ask the child, do you have a memory from a past life or whatever? I mean, to actually uncover that, if there was some kind of objective technique to uncover the memory, and you could confirm it. But I mean, obviously you can't. I mean, it kind of does beg the question, you know, are birth defects the result of, or the majority, or some of them at least, a result of past life traumas?
Yeah. When we can rule out genetics, or we can rule out, you know, things that happened during gestation, if we can rule all of that out, it is fair to wonder, because we do have a lot of cases where birth defects are related to past life memories. I mean, you know, and there are enough cases like this that we can see that link. You know, when you can rule out all other causes, it is fair to wonder. Obviously, you can't do more than just wonder unless you have, something to back it up with. But I think it is fair to wonder.
Yeah, it makes me wonder too if like skills and other things like that carry on as well, other than like the traumatic parts of it. Like, I guess maybe that goes into the karmic stuff, but I definitely wonder a lot.
No, it doesn't get into karma. Well, it depends on how you define karma. I like to use the term processual karma as opposed to juridical karma. The Asian kind of karma is more juridical, right? I mean, it's a judgmental karma. It's you know, we do certain things, and you know, and that, you know, our karma is derived from the things we did before, right? It's this moral tit for tat sort of thing. Whereas the processual kind of karma is not karma in that sense at all. It's simply carryovers. And processual, by that I mean, you know, it's just a process, right? In the whole process from death to rebirth. And when we look at it that way, yeah, I mean, if you're talking about karma that way, if we're simply talking about carryovers like that, and you know, and none of this moral stuff, you know, that what we go through now is due to what we did before, something like that. Blavatsky had this idea. She's the woman who developed theosophy. She talked a lot about karma, and she had this parable of a medieval prince. He murdered a lot of people, basically. He was not very kind to his subjects. He slit the throat of someone. As a consequence, some centuries later, and according to Blavatsky, in the reincarnations, some centuries later, and doesn't always occur on Earth. And here's another thing you see, it comes from Blavatsky, this idea that you know, we don't have to reincarnate on Earth, that also comes from theosophy. So then supposedly he was reborn and then began to develop throat disease and got to the point where, so what he did then redounds on him, right? And so he develops his throat disease because he cut somebody's throat, that type of thing. Whereas what we see in the cases is not, now Widjaratne, who was the boy who killed his bride and was born with a stunted arm, that's the very unusual kind of case. More often, well, there's a, I believe it was Turkish boy who, as a toddler, as toddlers will sometimes do, stuck his hand in a fodder chopping machine, and his fingers got chopped off. In his next life, he was born with his fingers chopped off, things like that, okay? Or a person is murdered in a certain way, that injury will show up either as birthmark or birth defect in the next life. So it's not the perpetrators of the crimes who bear the effects. It's the victims, right? Which is totally different from what Blavatsky said. It's totally different from karma theory, traditional karma theory, right? So, but if we think of our experiences conditioning what happens to us, which is what processual karma is about, what happens to us can carry over.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what my birthmarks are about, because I have some birthmarks. Oh. I don't know what it is.
What does your birthmark look like? Because in the reincarnation cases, the birthmarks are usually very specific. I mean, they're in the same place, and they have the same look, same appearance, often sometimes the same color.
So I actually have two very distinct ones. One is on my foot. It's pink. It looks like a hematoma kind of, but I've had it my whole life. It's like a pink little shape. It looks like, I don't even know, like a random shape. It's on the bottom of my right foot.
Amina, I have also one on the bottom of my left foot, and it's pink.
Okay. The bottom of the feet, that's an unusual place for a birthmark to be. However, it is a common place to mark bodies. This whole thing, when we get into reincarnation and all this stuff, I mean, it just really gets crazy sometimes. There are what are called experimental birthmarks, okay? This is Stevenson's term for them, experimental birthmarks. Basically, what it's about is cadaver mark. A deceased body is marked in order, with the idea that the mark is going to show up as a birthmark on the next body and allow tracing of, you know, of identifying of the next life, right? These marks are often put in inconspicuous parts of the body. I mean, the soles of the foot, for instance. You know, they can also be in parts of the body, like arms or something, or back of the neck, or you know, that's normally covered by clothing, so it's not too obvious. I mean, very rarely are these marks made in an obvious way. That's the first thing that occurs to me. Now, the whole practice of cadaver marking is much more common in Asia than it is in the West. There are things like this that are reported in the West, in Africa. They're most common in East Asia, but a big area. I mean, all the way from India to Japan, and you know, from Thailand to Mongolia. I mean, now probably a very, very old tradition. And there's no reason why other cultures could not have thought of this too. Like I say, we find some of this in Africa and occasionally in other places. So, but that's what birthmarks on the sole of the feet remind me. And Fadi, you said yours was pink. There's an experimental birthmark that was pink. It was produced by pink lipstick. Traditionally, these things are made from it's a soot from a cooking pot or something like that, and they tend to be dark in color. But then there, the Dalai Lama. I mean, the Dalai Lama, in his autobiography, talks about this in his family, where one of his may have been a younger brother who died before him and then was reborn after him. I'm not sure of the birth order here. But a child in the family died, and an oracle was consulted, and the oracle told his mother to mark the body with butter. The child would be returning in the family, and you can know. And in that case, the birthmark was very light. It was lighter than the skin. You know, but so in this case, they made the birthmark with red lipstick, and they made the mark with the red lipstick, and the corresponding birthmark is red. So,
wow, interesting. I want to get back to your story about the prince, the from Theosophy. We basically continue on into the next life with our same ego and all the other things. So this prince who was the perpetrator would reincarnate. And so what does your data suggest about like perpetrators besides the one that had the T-formed arm, I mean, which was unusual? Were there other perpetrators of crimes and other things? And was there any kind of physical consequence for them afterwards, or psychological consequence, or, you know, some kind of problems that they had afterwards, or what? I know the guy that had the arm didn't he have schizophrenia and stuff? He had to go.
Yeah, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
He had a lot of problems, but I mean, I was just curious to see to know if there was any results or any I hate to say consequences, but that sounds judgmental. But
right, there are not a great number of cases of people who did bad things. Right, there are a few, and it seems to the consequences seem to it's all psychological. If they feel guilt, that will carry over. If they have no guilt for what they did, there's no consequence. So it's a psychological thing, and it's
wow.
Yeah. If they hold themselves to account, or they're not held to account.
It kind of makes sense to me if you think about like our world and how our emotions really dictate our experience and what we believe and what we know about ourselves. It's kind of the experience you get in a way. So I feel like it kind of ties into that. Like however you feel when you die, however you feel about your life, like whatever your emotions about it are, I feel like you said, that's kind of what your next experience is related to.
In terms of emotions, yeah. I mean, my understanding is that it's desire based on emotions. There's an emotional component to desire, which right. is the actual manifesting force of what you become. So, I mean, it's all just, you're right. It is emotion, but it's emotion expressed as a desire, through a desire. You really right. want something, and you want it with an emotional force to it, and that makes results in our features.
Yeah, but emotion it really is key here. Core, it's a core issue. That's right. Everything is built around it. The same thing with the memories. I mean, the things that are recalled are the ones that have the most emotional salience. You know, and the things that are reproduced in the body as mirth marks are things that were emotionally significant for the previous person. So emotion really is key here. But yeah, I mean, emotion translates into desire and various other things.
I can't say in my experience that recollection of past life stuff has been really great for me becoming a more mature person. For example, in my case, for example, I'm aware of dying in World War II in an accident. And I do know that, you know, I was a typical young sailor or army guy chasing the girls, drinking too much alcohol, and, you know, and then really enjoying being in the military and everything, right? And so I'm born into my dad, who's exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and a lot of times what happens is that young men and their fathers or women and their fathers, they don't want to be like their parents. They have a judgment against their parents. They don't want to be like their parents at all. And they feel very uncomfortable when they discover that they like hold the fork the same way, or if they wave their hair the same way that their parents do. It's like, oh, yuck. Yeah. Oh, that's, you know, so-and-so did that. Oh, yuck. I hate that. Right. So then I go to remember the past life. Right. And I realize all this stuff about who I was. I did the same things that my dad kind of did, you know? So it's like, I have no basis for judging anymore, because I can't judge anybody anymore who drinks too much alcohol and has too much of a good time. You know, I really can't do that now, because I was that, you know. When you realize you were that, it's like, oh, in order for me to accept my own past life, you know, as me, then I have to accept all of it, all of my behaviors as well. So it becomes a really strong therapeutic tool to really remember past lives. And so I was just wondering, why do we forget? I mean, what's the point if it's such a useful tool? It doesn't make any sense that we forget when we're born again, except maybe for cultural reasons. But I mean, it would seem like it would be like, for people who actually really wanted to work on themselves, you know, it would be extremely beneficial to remember when you're born again. Oh, yeah, this is what happened in my past life. Oh, right. Yeah, I'm doing this again. I don't want to do this, blah, blah, blah. It seems like it's a shame that we forget when we're born again.
If we had full memory of another life, as well as trying to deal with this one, it would be very confusing. The past life memories for a lot of people who have them are not easy to deal with. A lot of these children who have these memories remember horrible things. They remember how they died. They remember being killed. They experience a lot of trauma because of that. So a lot of these memories are things that, and particularly when they stay with people past childhood, they're just very, it's very difficult to deal with them. All right. Even when the memories are not traumatic in that way, if you come back in the same family line, you're coming back in a different relationship to everybody. And you have to learn it all over again. You know, imagine what it's like. I mean, you're used to being a parent or a grandparent and now you're a grandchild, right? You got to learn to deal with the people that you used to treat as your children, grandchildren, as your elders now. So it's problematical for the kids. It's problematical for their elders. It just makes things difficult. And so I think that probably that there is a good psychological reason why we don't recall more.
It's the ego.
Right. Or whatever, you know.
Yeah. I actually have an experience of this. I mean, I could share. I had a girlfriend when I was 22, right? We dated for a short time. Okay. And it was like super passionate. And then boom, it was over. You know, very, very suddenly. And then I move on. And this was in a different country. I met her in a different country. Then I came back to America. And I had no idea what happened. I couldn't. And I was still like psychically attached to her and stuff. And then I told myself, or my ego told myself, a story about what happened and why that made it all go away. It all disappeared. It became okay. It became like, oh, it's no big deal. Fast forward 40 years to like last December, when I'm really digging into this, I realized that my ego had told me a lie. It wasn't true. That I had believed this lie for 40 years. So when they say, you know, I guess in psychology, I'm not a psychologist, but you know, I guess they say stuff like, you know, the ego protects you from certain things and stuff or whatever. So my belief is that the ego of the child just makes up a story to make the past life go away. Their ego just makes up a story and says, oh, that's not important. Bye, gone. And the memory is just gone. The judgment from the ego puts up a wall. It's like, it's a different story. It's a completely different thing. They'll just say, oh, that was just a fantasy or whatever when I was a child or something. I believe that's how a lot of us probably forgot, is because we couldn't, like we were talking about, they couldn't deal with the dichotomy of, you know, being in a past life and this life at the same time and the memory being so intense. And yeah, I think that's part of what the function is, because I know for myself that I have actually uncovered the lie, at least in a few cases. So I know that the ego lies to me. It makes up stories. Unfortunately, it seems like it actually also covers up past lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think you described the process very well, but I think it goes on unconsciously.
It's been really fascinating talking to you guys. I think we can close it out soon. It's been a while, but it's been amazing. I think, like we said earlier, these things, it's a lot of resistance, even though there's so much proof and evidence. And I just think that's crazy. So I feel like, you know, through podcasts and through you, Jim, doing what you do, like slowly the world is catching on. And I think that's really a beautiful thing.
There is a sweet, sweet spot between science and spirituality where they work together. And when we meet that spot, you know, we open ourselves up to so many things out there. The past lives, when we remember that, sometimes it's not just to know, it's to reconcile, because in one lifetime, you could have been a doctor and, you know, you were serving, you were helping people, you're giving yourself, you know, to the people. And in this lifetime, you're something else and you're supposed to live, you know, love yourself in this particular lifetime. So we come back to learn lessons. We come back to practice the lessons. If in one lifetime you are used to someone taking care of you, in this lifetime you are here to learn about taking care of others. And when we reach that spot where we learn, you know, our purpose that has brought us back, I think that is where we find the sweet fulfillment and content in life.